Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everyone. This is day 11 of our Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio. We're streaming live over on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. You can find all of our episodes over on iTunes and just search for us there, as well as Facebook and Twitter, by using the search bar and searching for Dog Works Radio. On the line is calling in from Southern California. He is our co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. We have a very exciting race. At the moment, as we're talking, there are 9 teams who have finished, a bunch of other teams who are out of White Mountain and on the way to Nome. A lot more race to happen, but we have a new record and a new slash old winner, although to call someone old when they're under 30 seems like it's a little bit wrong. But very exciting stuff that happened in the past 24 hours, and still a lot of race to go.
There is. Dallas Stevie came in this morning at 2:20 a.m. Alaska time, 8 days, 11 hours, 20 minutes, 16 seconds. Second place was his dad, Mitch Stevie, at 3:05 a.m. at 8 days, 12 hours, 5 minutes, 25 seconds. And then about 6 hours later was Ali Zirkel. You know, Alex, we were talking just the other day about Mitch Stevie and his projected finish time, and he said it was going to be 8 days, 18 hours, and he beat that record by 6 hours, and that just goes to show you how important these race schedules are, the run-rest schedules, and keeping to a very close timeline. He had it figured out 8 days, 18 hours, and he beat that by 12 hours, or 6 hours, finishing in 8 days, 12 hours. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of amazing, and we talked last night a lot about the rivalry between Dallas and Mitch. Dallas left White Mountain with only 6 dogs, and we were wondering if that would have an effect. It does not seem to have had much of an effect on him. Mitch had 10 dogs coming out of White Mountain, was not able to make up the 39 minutes between them, and actually ended up finishing just about 45 minutes behind his son. So very, very competitive run, last run down the coast. And Dallas is the type of racer who has always done extremely well in the last third of the race. He's always been able to really step on the gas and go very, very fast and make up a lot of time and pass a lot of teams. This year we were wondering if it was going to be different because he made a move towards the front much earlier than usual. But in the end, Dallas Stevie and his dogs just stronger and faster. And even though I know that Mitch gave it his all to try to catch him, just wasn't quite able to do it.
So Dallas in first, Mitch in second, Ali in third, Wade Mars, a very respectable fourth place, Peter Kaiser in fifth, Yor Olsen in sixth, Nicholas Pettit in seventh, Ralph Johansson in eighth, Jeff King in ninth, and pulling up pretty soon, it looks like Noah Burmeister and Scott Smith are the next due to be in, and they're only about 25 minutes apart at the last checkpoint. And then Richie Deal, Robert Sorley coming in 12th and 13th, if all things work. You know what is interesting, Alex, is the prize money. And if we could talk about that for just a second, the first place finisher gets $75,000, which is $5,000 more than last year, and I believe and a new truck, and I want to talk about that in just a second. And then the second place, I believe, is $67,000, and then third place is $53,000. But it's interesting because, you know, as we know, Dallas has won four Iditarods, so he has the choice of picking up four trucks. The truck is always the prize at the finish. And if you remember a couple of years ago, Alex, Lance Mackey, the most recent four-time winner, he was tired of picking up trucks, and he ended up getting a Dodge Charger that he ended up auctioning off. These folks are able to get anything that Dodge, Chrysler, or Jeep provides there at the local dealership. What would you pick if you had three trucks already in the driveway?
Huh. That's an interesting question. I would love to get a Chevy Volt. Oh, but I guess that doesn't count because it's not Dodge.
Right.
I don't know. I'd probably get a new truck and replace one of the old ones.
Well, you know, those trucks that he has aren't very old. I mean, he's won four races in the last 5 years, so I think those trucks in the driveway still have some tread on the tires. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm sure they do, and especially the most recent ones. You know, it is amazing that we've talked a lot about how kennels will go through these 4 or 5 year periods where they just are on top of the world, and this definitely has been that kind of period for the last 5 years for Dallas Seavey. Four wins in the past 5 years, three wins in a row. And then the 1 year that he didn't win, he still came in fourth, which is more than respectable. So
right.
a really incredible string of races that Dallas has been able to put together.
So what else is on the plate tonight? As we know, folks are going to be continuing to come in over the next several days. We still have 73 teams total. So what is that? 66 teams, 65, I guess it is, still on
64.
The 64 teams still on the trail. So we still have a lot of racing to do coming in the next few days. What do you think's next on the Iditarod plate, so to speak?
Well, you know, there's a couple of interesting things that happened. Wade Mars and Pete Kaiser came in less than 3 minutes apart in fourth and fifth, so they were really battling going up the coast and up onto Front Street. I think a lot of people are going to be talking about, in the next few days, are going to be talking about Jeff King, and even though he had a very strong finish in ninth place, I think it's human nature to want to play the what-if game about what might have happened had he not had the attack on his dog team and not lost the one dog's life and several other dogs who had to be dropped. He was certainly making a very strong move towards the front. Because of Dallas's team and how strong Dallas's team is, it may not have been enough, but it's difficult not to think that he would have been right up there in the top two or three.
Right. So tonight you want to talk about a pretty interesting subject in regards to different dogs on different teams. Lay it out for us and we'll talk about it for a few.
Yeah, so one of the things that I have noticed and am anxious to get your perspective as a musher, a lot of times you will hear about Iditarod teams, and I guess teams in other races as well, who are a little bit shorthanded. So they will sometimes borrow a dog from another kennel, and a dog that perhaps has experience as a leader or just experience in that type of race. They'll borrow a dog. Sometimes they will buy a dog specifically for running a race and wanting to have a dog that will complement their team or a dog that has specific types of experience. And you don't often hear about this unless you go kind of deep into the coverage that we talk a lot about how Certainly the mushers are important, and their strategy and their scheduling and their dog pair is very, very important. But ultimately it's the dogs who are going to make this team. And it is much, much harder, especially when you have up to 16 dogs on a team, to keep track of exactly which dog is where and which dog is running that has experience or which dog is running that doesn't have experience. But I've been noticing a lot this year that the press coverage is talking about mushers who've gotten specific dogs from other kennels to run the Iditarod or to run the Yukon Quest. So I'm wondering what you think about that practice.
Well, first off, if I can explain a little bit about how dogs are tracked out on the Iditarod Trail by Iditarod and the mushers. Every dog is given a numbered tag. For example, Hugh Neff started out at, 73rd place, I believe, 70th place.
Mm-hmm.
And all of his tags will have the number 70 on them, and then A through, R or Q. And each one of those dogs represents a different letter and a different number, a same number but different letter. So when that dog is entered into the vet book, for example, on Hugh's team, his dog George, which is one of his main leaders, just happens to have his bib number and G for George. So if that dog is checked in or dropped off or dropped or whatever, that tag follows him until he's picked up by the handlers. So that tag stays with them the whole time. In regards to switching out dogs, selling, buying, trading, whatever, we've talked a lot about it on the show this year about how important it is for younger dogs to get the experience to go to Nome. And I know several mushers that have dogs that may not make it on their main team will send these dogs to other kennels. We've talked about the rookie mushers and the back of the packers. They will get dogs to fill their teams with some of these younger dogs or some of these dogs that will fulfill their goals but not necessarily be a competitive race dog. In terms of buying dogs, of course, that's a big business in mushing, especially when the dog is a superstar on somebody's team. You know, you're always looking to have that, that first string quarterback, so to speak, on your team to be able to step up and pull through in the race. So it is a very common occurrence. We have probably at least a third of our kennel of dogs that came from other dog kennel, other mushers, other kennels that we use. We primarily use our dogs to train younger dogs since they're retired from, in most cases, on Hugh's team. They've came over to us, and we train our younger dogs with that. So there is always that play, and it's very similar to, you know, to football, how draft picks are made, and you know, dogs ride the bench on one season or on first string the next season or practice squad the following season and all that. So there is a lot of play there. And you're right. It is all about the dogs. And when we talk about our next subject, I'm going to kind of hammer that home a little bit and kind of go from there. Any other questions in regards to that? Anything I didn't cover there?
Yeah, I have one question, but just want to point out, not hopefully not to confuse our listeners, but when we're talking about buying dogs or trading dogs or being loaned dogs, that all takes place before the race starts. Once the race starts, you have your dogs, and those are your dogs that have to go with you, you know, as far as they can go, and you have to have at least, I believe, 5 or 6 in harness to get to know. So you can't switch out dogs in the middle of the race, but this is, you know, jockeying for position on teams before the race. My question for you is, how do mushers find out about dogs that are available? Is there, you know, is it just the people hear about it over the grapevine, or is there some sort of centralized, organization or publication or something where people would go for this?
Well, you know, Facebook is an amazing thing, and that's where a lot of the transactions are happening. I know several big mushing kennels will sell and buy dogs all the time. They'll list them on Facebook and they're sold within minutes, and it could be several hundred to a couple of thousand dollars for these dogs that, you know, come and go out of kennels. You know, it's interesting if we could switch sports a little bit in terms of the sprint mushing world. You know, I was talking to a good friend of mine who's a world-class sprinter, and he says the best time to buy and sell dogs is right after a sprint race, especially if that team did very well. Obviously, their asking price will go up significantly if the team did very well. So I know, you know, places like the Ferrandi and the Open North American Championships and the races up in Tokes, there's a heck of a lot of bartering going around the dog trucks after the race is over.
Yeah, and I imagine that, you know, every year at the end of the season, there are people who make the decision if they want to get out, or if they want to, you know, have some sort of change in their life or move somewhere else, and that it's probably a good chance towards the end of the season when you know someone is going to be making a change or making a move that you could be able to get some of their dogs. Recently, Jake Berkowitz decided he was going to get out of mushing, and I believe that he essentially sold all of the members of his team, of his kennel.
Right. And you would be surprised, Alex, aside from dogs, it's truly a garage sale right after Iditarod, with everybody selling their gear, especially for those folks that are not interested in running again. You'll see sleds for sale and parkas and snow machines and everything going at rock bottom prices to get sold so they can move on, especially for the rent-a-team mushers and, you know, the lease teams and such.
So I guess the lesson here is, if you want to go and do that, then the end of the season or right after a big race is the right time to be in there when people are getting rid of their stuff.
I think so, because you know how it goes. You know, the Christmas items go on sale on the 26th, and so does everything else, I guess. So I guess that's a good time to buy a sled or a brand new parka.
Excellent. Well, I know that we wanted to get into the big story of the day, which leads into a larger topic. We had a very odd and interesting circumstance last night when we were on the air. It was Dallas Seavey and Mitch Seavey and Ali Zirkel and Brent Sass were all up in White Mountain, and Brent was in third place, about 4 hours behind Dallas. When it came time for Brent to leave White Mountain, he got his team all in harness. My understanding is they went a couple of hundred yards and then basically just stopped. And he eventually came back to the checkpoint, gave them a nap, decided that he would wait for a while, feed them and try to get them going. But essentially, we had a dog team that was in third place just decide they were not going to go. And since then, I believe he's been passed by, he did eventually get them going, but he was passed by, I think, 20 other teams. So to go from third place to 20th place, it has got to be very disheartening, especially. You know, I don't think that he would have been able to make up the time and win the race, but he was certainly right up there in contention. And then the team just decided they were not going any further.
And that mistake ultimately cost him anywhere between $40,000 and $50,000 in prize money. So it was a very big mistake in terms of chasing after a win or a top three or four finish. So, you know, first and foremost, this race is all about the dogs. And I know we spend 2 weeks every year talking about all of the mushers and talking about the musher profiles and, you know, who's doing what and how they got started. But very rarely, unfortunately, do we ever talk a lot about the dogs. Now, there's a reason behind that. There is well over, 1,500 dogs or so starting the race in Willow, so it's difficult to not only know about many of those dogs, but definitely able to cover them in any way. But as I mentioned last night, or it could have been the night before, when the dogs don't want to go, they're not going to go. And I told this story about how my dog shut down on the Kinnick 200 because it was too hot and ended up having to scratch several years ago because they pretty much did what Brent's dogs did. I was about 10 miles or so from the checkpoint. They left okay. You know, everybody was in harness. They were up and ready to go. And we got pretty much in the middle of the big swamp here in Willow, and they said, hey, guy, we're done. We're going to lay down. We're going to relax. And there's nothing more frightening, more frustrating than that happening to you pretty much in the middle of nowhere. But it's often a common occurrence. I know it happened just this year with Michelle Phillips. She was having a real hard time several checkpoints back. I believe it was in Galena. It's happened to Didi Genro on the coast. It happened several years ago, and we've talked about it several times on this show with an individual where his dog stopped in safety just 25 miles from Nome, and he could not get his dogs to go for any reason. And one of the officials said, why don't you just start walking? They'll follow you. And he did, and he just started walking, and the dogs kind of said, hey, where's our musher going? And they eventually caught up to him and passed him. He jumped on the back of the runners and took off. But the bigger story here is you have to know when to stop and rest your dogs. And, you know, that's sort of the point of controversy or point of discussion today is, do these people, not necessarily, including Brent here, but I guess we could if we wanted to, do these people drive their dogs too hard? Are they making ill decisions so they can have a better spot in a race? Are they reading their dogs correctly? You know, there's many things that we could get into without really speculating, but I guess the bottom line here, Alex, is the dogs are the ones that are running the race. The mushers are the ones that are driving the race, and it's very similar to driving a car. If you don't have four wheels on the ground on your car, you're not going very far.
Right, and, you know, again, I'm not a musher, so I'm reluctant to criticize anyone because I wasn't there and don't know exactly what happened, and secondly, I don't feel like I have the expertise to know what should or shouldn't be done out on the trail, but there's been a considerable amount of controversy today with people criticizing Brent and saying that Brent pushed his dogs way too hard, even though he stopped for several hours outside of White Mountain. So he did try to give his dogs an extra break before he got to White Mountain, but perhaps just going too fast up the coast and trying to push his dogs to go to run harder and to run longer than they really should have. On the other hand, you know, Brent Sass is a guy who has been extremely successful in a lot of races, including the Yukon Quest. So I would think that someone like that would really have a pretty good handle on his dogs and what his dogs are capable of and what they need.
I agree, but think about it this way, Alex. Have you ever been in a position in any type of sports where, you know, you see the finish line, you know the end is coming, and you just push that little bit too far, whatever sport it may be, whether it's a 5K or a marathon or, you know, trying to get that last touchdown on fourth down, whatever, you make a decision that's probably not in the best interest of the team, but you gamble with it, and sometimes the gamble works, sometimes it doesn't. But in mushing, obviously there is a live being that can say, whoa, we're not doing this, we're going to shut down here, unlike a piece of equipment, an automobile, whatever it is in any other sport. You have something with a mind that's able to say, we're putting the brakes on, we're not going any further.
Right, and I would think that this is because, as we've talked about a lot, there's a lot of exhaustion that sets in after people have been out on the trail for 5 or 6 days, And certainly by the end of the race, people are really tired and maybe are not making decisions in the same way that they would if they were fully rested. So that possibly could come into play. And I know we talk a lot about run-rest schedules and sticking to run-rest schedules. I don't know if Brent tried to push his team a little bit more than what his schedule called for. I suspect there'll be a lot of people looking for answers to that, and I'm sure that in the next few days he'll be providing some of those answers. But it really is. We see this frequently in kind of middle of the pack teams and back of the pack teams. I don't recall recently seeing something happening at a team that was really in contention to win the race.
Right. And we mentioned Didi a few years back. I was reading that story earlier today about where she had this same sort of shutdown on the sea ice, which was a little bit further back than White Mountain, but definitely closer to the finish than not. And she had a heck of a time out there trying to get these dogs to go. And you know, it's like I said, they just pretty much said, you know, we're not going. And now it could be a leader issue. It could be a timing issue. It could be a run-rest schedule issue. It could be pushing them too hard. It could be too hot. You know, there's all sorts of factors that they could have lost the trail. You know, there's all sorts of factors that we aren't going to speculate on, but there are reasons behind it. And almost always it's a musher problem. Either they pushed them too hard or they made an ill calculation that caused the dogs to stop.
Right. And if you're in that position, if you can manage to get a dog in lead who is willing to go, are the other dogs usually, do they usually fall into line, or can you have the case where you have one dog, a leader who wants to go, and then the rest of the team still doesn't want to go?
Yeah, in my case, it's usually the leaders that want to stop. I have a dog that's notorious for doing this, and obviously she doesn't run on our team anymore. Her name is Vela. She starts races very strong, and then she figures out, about 100, 150 miles in, that it's her time to pull off to the side of the trail and roll around in the snow and quit. Now, obviously that's not a dog you want on a competitive team, but just trying to get down the trail, I would start her in lead just to have, you know, a spare leader in the team. So, unfortunately, that dog would make the decision every time. She was a quitter. She was, you know, the person on the team that wasn't giving 110%. If you think about other sports, they're loafing on sprints, or they're leaving practice early or showing up late, whatever analogy you want to use. But typically it is the leaders that are the ones that are pulling the team. But in Britt's case today, he started off from White Mountain the second time, trailing Ray Reddington Jr. And Ray Reddington was doing fine on his run-rest schedule. He left on time. And pretty much Brent's dogs gave chase to Ray. And that's very common in mushing. The dogs will want to catch up to the leader, the team in front. And it's sort of a hopscotch down the trail, and they'll pass each other, especially if dog teams are having difficulty, if there's two teams that are having difficulty. And this is very common at the back of the packers. A team will lead for a while, and then they'll kind of get burned out, and then whoever they're traveling with will pass, and they'll lead for a while, and they'll sort of hopscotch down the trail like that because they just don't have a strong enough dog team to be able to do it. And I'm a firm believer that the mind of a sled dog is just as important as their heart or as their body. If a dog is not strong-minded, they don't make a very good sled dog.
Right. And, it sounds like the dog that you have that really wants to quit all the time is one of these, and we see this in human athletes as well, someone who thinks that the idea of doing something is very appealing and sounds great, but then when you get to the actual nuts and bolts of it, they aren't that interested. They don't want to put in the time, or they don't want to put in the effort, or for whatever reason, the idea of doing it is much more exciting than the actuality of doing it.
Exactly. So, which brings us to our Musher profile this evening. You have a pretty interesting story here, and it's a great tie-in. And I guess we've spent a lot of time today talking about the dogs on the race, and that's what's important to me. And I'm glad we're spending the half hour really getting into this, because it is about those 1,000-plus dogs out there on the trail. But you have a story about today's Musher profile with Mary Helwig, and she has a dog that is known for never quitting. So let's talk about her, but let's tell her story first. She is one of the Mushers that really persevered this year, isn't she?
Yeah, she has been running almost all the race toward the back of the pack and at the back of the pack. She currently is ahead of Ellen Halverson, but is second to last. This is her first Iditarod. She's running as a rookie. She grew up in California. Her family owns a winery in the Shenandoah Valley, which is east of Sacramento, Helwig Winery. And they list her on their website as their Alaska PR representative. And if you click on her on the website, the picture that comes up is her with a dog team and a sled. She grew up in Southern California, went to school in Chicago, moved to Unalakleet. In 2006, she was working for a Christian nonprofit called Covenant Youth of Alaska, and that is an organization that takes, I believe, at-risk youth and gives them outdoor adventures. So she was working there as a youth leader in the winters, and during the summer she was a cook in a Bible camp out there near Unalakleet. Spent a lot of time in local villages, traveling and doing outdoor programs. And then she ran a sprint race for women, a women-only sprint race out of Unalakleet. And when she was on the runner, she thought, this is great, I want to do this. She got a dog named Bravo from an accidental litter, and at first the dog was a house dog. Then she started doing a little bit more mushing, she put him in harness. He was never a lead dog, but he was always a dog that was a good, solid dog on her team. And she was running in the Copper Basin, one of the qualifiers for Iditarod, and had stopped to help another team, and her dog team was stopped and was on the trail for quite a while she was helping another musher. And then once that was all straightened out, she tried to get her team to go, and they just refused. They were all like, nope, we are resting here. It's very comfortable. We're not going to move. And she kept trying different combinations, moving the dogs, putting different dogs in lead. And then Bravo, even though he wasn't a leader, she thought, I'll try him in lead. And he just got up and said, okay, we're doing this, and started running. The rest of the team followed, and she decided that he was a very, very important dog for her team. And in many ways, I hear stories like this over and over again, that people talk about one particular dog that is kind of the spirit of their kennel, that encompasses everything that they want to do in mushing or in Iditarod. So for her, that dog is Bravo, and then she named her kennel after Bravo. She worked after doing races like the Portage 200, where you run from Unalakleet to Caltag and then back. She worked as a handler for Mitty Johnson in Unalakleet, then worked for a while for Didi Genre as a handler, started getting her own dogs, breeding her dogs, training them, running qualifiers. She had a few dogs from Mitty Johnson. She bought a female dog named Cosmo from Michelle Phillips, who had finished the Yukon Quest in 2013, and she didn't have any females at the time who were able to breed successfully. So she got Cosmo with the idea of breeding Cosmo and being able to raise her own litters and start her own team really from Cosmo. She's a neighbor of yours up in Willow. Her home was destroyed by the Sockeye fire last summer, which was just devastating for a lot of local mushers. She had packed up and evacuated her important stuff, all of her dogs, much of her equipment, her computer. She wasn't sure that she would have to evacuate, but then got the word and came down and stayed with Kristen Bacon, who's a little bit farther south, I believe. And then at the Iditarod picnic, which they hold every summer to honor the volunteers, she decided that she was going to sign up for Iditarod, even though she had lost so much of her worldly possessions. And she told an interviewer that dogs are what has kept her going, and dogs give her purpose, and the Iditarod is everything that she'd been working towards, so she was just going to run it. She also said that dealing with the fire and the aftermath of that and rebuilding would help her with the challenges that she would face out on the trail. Amazingly, when she got back to where her house and her kennel was, the fire went all the way up to her sled, but the sled was unharmed. It didn't burn. Nothing melted on it. And she said that she felt that this was a sign that she should continue mushing. She also had four puppies who were born in a litter just a few days after the fire started. She has a BA in psychology, has worked as a financial analyst, and is currently going back to school studying to become a vet tech. She doesn't have a website per se, but she has a blog at mushingmary.blogspot.com, which, even though it hasn't been updated in a long time, has a lot of great information about her raising her puppies and the various puppies who were born on her kennel. And she is very, very active on Facebook, and her family has been posting daily updates, sometimes two updates a day on her Facebook about exactly where she is and what challenges she's facing and how she's doing on the race. So even though she doesn't have a website yet, I would imagine that's something that she'll be working on in the off season. She's got a lot of stuff going on in social media, and it's fairly easy to keep track of her on Facebook.
You know, Alex, we talked about the Sockeye fire right after it happened here on Mushing Radio back in the summer. And we're about 6 or 7 miles from the fire line of the fire, but we did have to evacuate as well. We live in the same neighborhood as Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Vern Halter, but Mary lived in the same neighborhood as several Iditarod kennels. She lives in the neighborhood or very close to Didi Genro's kennel. Justin High, who is also a Iditarod musher, Jan Steves and her partner Bob Klupach live over there. Lev Schwartz lives over there as well. Several very prominent Iditarod kennels were right there in that area, and just about all of them lost everything that they had. We've heard the story with Didi, how she lost her home and her dad's restored hot rod that they had in the garage. And Mary was one of these folks that lost everything as well. She bought a house just before the fire from a longtime local musher supporter named Donna Quante, who takes absolutely fabulous pictures of mushing and the local races around here. She runs a business called Husky Productions. She happened to move back east and sold her house to Mary right before the fire. So she was a very new resident to Willow at the time, but unfortunately she lost her fire. And what's interesting about Mary, Alex, is she was living in a camper trailer, an RV, for for months after the fire. And I remember reading on her Facebook page, she was having a very difficult time finding an excavator before, you know, the cold set in and the snow fell, to be able to excavate a new foundation for her house. And she finally found one and got all the footings in, and I believe she finally moved into the house just shortly after Christmas. I don't believe it is finished, but she lived in that RV trailer for months in the bitter cold early winter here in Willow, and we saw temperatures of well below 25 below, and I remember her saying on her Facebook page, how much longer is this going to take? You know, this propane bill for the little stove in the RV is breaking the bank. You know, obviously she had to fill it up every couple of days just to keep her little house warm. But you're right. For whatever reason, her sled survived all of that catastrophe, and she got her things together, and through perseverance and will and good luck and great sponsors and friends, I know Kristen Bacon and Jeff King helped her out a lot in putting in a new dog yard and, you know, excavating that sort of stuff with a little bobcat bulldozer. And, you know, without the help of the mushing community, which I found this summer is one of those things that it's one of those bonds that if something's going on, they're there to help. And Mary and her neighborhood over there were really pulling together, and people from all over the world helped those folks out. And she made it. You know, she's still doing her thing. She is close to the Red Lantern, back the back of the pack. But I believe she'll finish. What do you think?
I think she will. I'm fairly certain that she will finish. She does seem to be doing very, very well for a rookie. Maybe a little bit slower than she would like, but is making really, really good, steady progress. So I would not at all be surprised to see her finish and possibly move up a little bit in the ranking. She will still be most likely at the back of the pack, but you know, might be able to pass two or three mushers on the way to Nome.
You know, one last point, Alex, and then we're going to move on for today, is we did not have any scratches since we were on the air at about the same time last night, which is good to hear. You will often see quite a few more scratches along the trail. Ellen Halverson is in the Red Lantern position right now, and she is just in Galena, where Mary Helwig is in Nualto, and then several mushers there are in Caltag, and then several more are in Unicolete. And you'll often see kind of a group of mushers, if they're going to scratch, they'll often scratch there at Unicolete. And I believe that's mainly for a logistical reason. It's a place where, you know, I don't want to say it's a good place to scratch, but if you're going to scratch somewhere, if you can make it to Unicolete, that seems to be where a lot of teams do scratch. Have you noticed that in recent history?
Yeah, I have. It's one of the few places on the trail where there is commercial air flight in and out. So it's basically Nome, Unicolete, and McGrath have regular commercial flights in and out. So in that sense, it's kind of a hub logistically for dogs that are dropped, or generally in the latter part of the race, there's a big dog yard there, and then they're flown back to Anchorage from there. So it's a relatively large village or city. I'm not sure if it's considered a city, but it's a relatively large and well populated, at least compared to many of the villages, which have, you know, a few dozen to a few hundred people living in them.
Right. And this just in, Alex, in 10th place, Scott Smith came in at 5:33 local time, and then Noah Burmeister pulled into Nome at 6:39. So just about 5 minutes ago, the 11th place finisher, Noah Burmeister, pulled into the finish line. So we still have a lot of racing to go. Alex and I are scheduled to be on the air here at least through Sunday evening, so we have 5 or 6 days left of our coverage We're kind of burning the midnight oil, so to speak, but there's still a lot of racing to go, a heck of a lot of stories to tell out there. In closing tonight, do you have anything else? And if not, who are we talking about tomorrow evening?
So tomorrow evening we're going to talk about Jason Campo from Alberta, Canada. Will be our musher of the day. One story that I keep meaning to mention and then forget about it every night, so I'll just mention it here because it occurred to me. We talked a little bit about, and there was a lot of press coverage, about the trainload of snow that was brought in from Fairbanks to Anchorage. And then it turned out a couple days after the start, it was revealed that that snow was actually not used because it wasn't, when it was collected, it wasn't sifted well enough. So there were a lot of rocks in the snow, and they were worried that this might affect the paws of the dogs. So that those 12 train car loads full of snow ended up not being used.
Yeah, I heard that. And, you know, when they do that, they just gather that snow from the streets when they plow, and that's, I guess, just dumped snow. And I remember seeing at the ceremonial start, there's all kinds of stuff in there, whether it be plastic bags and, you know, pieces of trash and everything that is sort of, you know, discarded along the road is kind of swept up there and put in that snow. And that's what was going on with the snow from Fairbanks. And, you know, there was a lot of contention and controversy on that subject, Alex, especially up here in Alaska. We're facing that budget cut, and, you know, everybody's sort of running for the hills in the recession, so to speak. But a lot of comments were made about who in the world paid for that snow. Was it the city of Anchorage? Was it Iditarod? Do you happen to have the answer to that?
I don't believe it was the city of Anchorage. It might have been Iditarod, or it might have been a private sponsor decided to pay for that. I know that it wasn't I heard that it was not a special train, but it was a regular train that was coming through. So I don't think there was a lot of extra cost with transporting it, but there might have been some cost involved with gathering the snow up in Fairbanks.
Well, thanks to my roving reporter here, my wife Michelle, she just passed a note saying that it was a gift to the Iditarod or the city of Anchorage from the Alaska Railroad. So there's that answer.
Excellent. It's always good to have an intrepid reporter in the house.
Yes, it is. And unfortunately, the gift went unused. I guess it's sort of like those socks you get from your aunt at Christmas time.
Sticks and rocks.
Yes, we know that it's a great gesture, but sometimes it's unwanted, if you know what I mean.
It might have been re-gifted to Eagle River, perhaps.
Very good. Alex, thanks for going over tonight. We'll see you guys next time. On behalf of my co-host tonight, Alex Stein, have a good evening and talk to you tomorrow. Goodbye.